You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Florida Governor Rick Scott thinks it's just a peachy idea to arm up the delegates to the Republican National Convention in Tampa later this year. With an eye on safety, though, the city has banned things that could be weapons. Can't have any of those protesters walking around with a crowbar or a squirt gun or a piece of string longer than 6 inches long. I suppose you could make it into a garret. However, an attempt by the mayor of Tampa to also ban handguns during the RNC was shot down by Governor Rick Scott this week. A 2011 law passed in Florida prevents cities from regulating firearms. So much for local control, huh? And Governor Scott refused to offer an exemption in this case, arguing it would violate the Second Amendment. So get ready for this year's RNC, where the Occupy protesters can be arrested for carrying string or water guns, but Republican delegates are encouraged to stick a 38 in their pants. Noel Flasterstein is on the line with us. He is a gun rights expert and advocate, NRA referral attorney, and general counsel for the Second Amendment Club of America, the website, and the Florida Carry Consulting Attorney, floridacarry.org, gunrightsforyou.com. Noel, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on, Tom.
Noel, this seems to me like it's, you know, are gun nuts violating the rights of average Americans? I mean, this has gone, and I use that term advisedly, this has gone to the point of absurdity. You're going to have all kinds of people in a pressure cooker environment. You know, within a year and a half, I don't know how long ago it was that Gabby Giffords was shot, of an attempted political assassination, all these politicians from all over the country and probably all over the world coming in. And you want to say to the mayor of Tampa that he should not have the authority to, and he answers to his citizens. So the people of the city of Tampa should not have the authority to say, no, we don't want guns in our city.
Well, I mean, that's totally absurd. I mean, you know, Florida law, I mean, Governor Scott correctly, you know, gave his opinion with respect to the matter, the request that Mayor Buckhorn was making, and said, hey, I can't do this. I can't violate the Second Amendment. We got to remember now, this, the when they have the RNC convention down here, first of all, you got the federal security zone, which is immediately around the convention where the delegates are and such forth. And that's federal law. No one's allowed to have a firearm that's, you know, unless they're authorized to do so, meaning they would be Secret Service, FBI, something on law enforcement, something along those natures. So it's not like we have a...
But you got bars, you got hotels, you got parties, and Noel, you're an attorney. You know that it is not... First of all, the power even of the courts to determine constitutionality is not in the Constitution. It was claimed by the Supreme Court in 1803 in Marbury versus Madison. And so, secondly, it's clearly not the job of a governor to be enforcing the Second Amendment of the Constitution. That's a phony argument.
But it's also not the job of a mayor of the city of Tampa to do away with the Constitution and put it on hold when...
Whether he is or isn't is a matter of opinion. It's the duty of the mayor, though, to respond to the people. They put him into office. They can vote him out if they don't like what he does. Clearly, he wouldn't be asking for this if he didn't think the people of Tampa wanted it. The guy's a politician.
Just his friends, liberal group, they're the ones that would want that. The pro-gun control people would want that. But
the police department wants that.
Well, regardless.
That's the fringe liberals, the cops in Tampa?
They don't always get it right. Well, most of the time they do. But you know what? The police do not have the authority because I have a constitution, which gives me the right to, you know, have a warrant for probable cause before I'm arrested, which requires that, you know, they can't do an unreasonable search for me. And, of course, I have my Second Amendment, which gives me the right to have a firearm to keep and protect myself. Now, here in Florida, we have concealed carry applications or permits, which people must apply for, which they go through a criminal background check. And if I'm in the downtown area doing business unrelated to the RNC, hey, the criminal just got word that there are no guns allowed in downtown. Hey, let's go have a free-for-all and start robbing people because we know, if anything, there's a good chance that they're law-abiding. They're not going to be armed. They're not going to be protecting themselves because Mayor Buckhorn decided that he would just do away with the Second Amendment. Now, let's talk about that.
Yeah, that's such a pathetic argument because you know as well as I do that more people are killed accidentally by guns in their homes, more people commit suicide than people protect themselves from criminals. It's a phony argument. It's a canard.
No one is killed.
And shouldn't the Occupy Wall Street protesters get guns so they can all have a shootout? I mean, why are you not calling on the RNs on the National Rifle Association? You know, I've heard several commentators now on the right say this is really important that these delegates and the people going to the RNC have guns because all those protesters are going to be there and they need to protect themselves. I've never seen a gun at an Occupy protest. Maybe you guys should go down there, set up a table, and start registering Occupy protesters and teaching them how to use firearms. Yeah, great sales opportunity for Walmart and the NRA.
Well, I seriously doubt, and you know as well as I, that most occupiers probably don't fit the profile of a gun owner, but some of them do.
Well, shouldn't they? Aren't they as vulnerable to crime as anybody else if that's why you think people should have guns?
It's a right if they want to exercise it. Now, I don't think they should allow the sale of alcohol while the RNC is going on in downtown with all the heightened emotions.
Good luck with that.
And getting drunk. Exactly.
As you know, alcohol and hookers are going to be flowing. Republicans are coming to town. Come on.
Well, I'm not going to comment on that. Unfortunately, that is one of the things, you know, with the adult entertainment. Is one of the things that Tampa is known for, and so I'm sure that may have played a part into why they chose to come to Tampa. But either case, still.
But you know, how can it be back to this original, this core question here? What, you know, there are New York City. The mayor has said you can't have a gun without a permit.
He's a communist.
He's not a communist, and no court has thrown him out. He's a Republican. He's a billionaire. Come on, give me a break. And so the mayor of Tampa, you know, is saying, you know, we're not even saying year round like New York City. We're saying like, you know, for 4 days during the RNC. There's nothing unconstitutional about that. There's nothing illegal about that. Rick Scott is just pandering to the NRA. He's just trying to get more campaign bucks from the hard right.
He is not pandering to the NRA. He is the one that set up the task force to review our standard ground law, which obviously has got quite a bit of attention due to the trademark.
A task force which is 100% made up of people who were either on the ALEC committee that actually wrote and passed the Stand Your Ground, Shoot First law, or legislators who advocated for it. Not one single person who was opposed to it, or even who was neutral, is on this so-called task force that Rick Scott has put together to so-called look into what happened in the Trayvon Martin killing and the standard and its relationship to the Stand Your Ground, Shoot First laws. Come on, give me a break, Noel.
I disagree with that. There are people.
That's a statement
on that
of fact.
Task force. There are people on that task force that are, you know, in opposition to the Stand Your Ground law. But the point still
if so, they've come to Jesus pretty late in the game because all these people were early supporters of it, on the record.
Well,
either way,
I don't think
you find the list over at thinkprogress.org.
All he did was say, "Hey, I can't do what you're asking, Mayor Buckhorn. I'm not going to violate the Constitution." And besides, look at the Gabby Gifford shooting. When that happened, that too was near a federal security zone. So if they would have banned, which I don't know if they did or didn't, the entire downtown area of where she was speaking from anybody exercising their constitutional right or having a firearm on them if they had a concealed weapons permit, that wasn't going to stop the nut job that shot her. So all we're going to do, and even here in Florida, there are areas such as colleges, secondary schools, which, you know, firearms, even if you do have a concealed permit, you're not allowed to lawfully carry your firearm there.
So we have 300 million firearms in this country. Isn't, you know, Yemen is the next most armed country in the world, and they have half as many guns per person as we do. Half! It seems to me like a national insanity. Noel, I intended to leave you the last word. I'm sorry, but we're flat out of time. Next time, I promise. Noel Flasterstein, gun rights advocate and expert, et cetera, at gunrightsforyou.com. Thanks, Noel.
Thank you, Tom.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back in just a few minutes with, I just want to rant a little bit about this whole issue and whether or not we've gone insane.
Send lawyers, guns, and money.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program, Occupying the Media, 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. The rights of the unarmed. You know, there's all these guys swaggering around talking about the rights of Americans to own guns.
I got a 38 in my pants. I got a 45 in my pants. You know, there's definitely an undercurrent of that. There are 300 million guns in the United States. That's about one for every person. The world's second most heavily armed country on a per capita basis is Yemen. They're doing really well, right? No crime at all in Yemen. And they only have half as many guns per person as we do. Think about that. The second most heavily armed country in the world has half as many guns as we do. Is this not a national illness? But because most gun owners, and I'm not saying that you're ill if you have a gun. I love to play with guns myself. I've been to the shooting range. I, you know, go to my brother's house and shoot his guns. But there's something about the fetishizing of this that, and particularly the legal fetishizing of it, where we're passing laws that say that if you're in a public area and you feel threatened, typically, you know, it used to be that what you had to do is de-escalate, step back. And if the threat doesn't go away, then you can, you know, respond. But if it does, then that's how we're supposed to behave as people. But 25 states now have laws that say if you feel threatened, all you got to do is pull your gun out and shoot. You don't even have to know that person has a gun. They can have Skittles and a can of tea. And because most gun owners in America have more than one gun, only one in five people owns a gun in the United States, which means four out of five of us are unarmed. Four out of five of us are walking around without a gun. In fact, probably, you know, 95 out of 100 of us are walking around without a gun. Very few people actually carry weapons with them. Probably, you know, 999 out of 1,000 of us are walking around without a gun. But four out of five of us don't own guns. And our rights, those of us who are not gun owners, as Americans, our rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, those rights that the Declaration of Independence says we were willing to fight a war with Great Britain to protect, those rights are being routinely violated by trigger-happy gun owners and by ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, and Walmart and the NRA who wrote these shoot-first laws. Josh Horowitz of the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence wrote a great blog post. It's over at Huffington Post right now, titled Second Amendment Vigilantes Systematically Dismantle Our Rights. And in that blog, he said, and I'm quoting him now, I'm quoting Josh, he said, "We have reached a point where many of the rights and privileges we take for granted are being threatened not by a tyrannical government, but by overbearing individuals with guns. They infringe on rights that are central to the American system of justice, such as property rights, the presumption of innocence, and the right to redress of grievances through the courts." And just think of that. Somebody pulls a gun on you and shoots you, your right to redress through the courts, pretty much gone. Your presumption of innocence, that's toast. And whatever that other one was there. It's a sad statement about contemporary America when a teenager can no longer safely venture outside to buy a bag of Skittles. End of quote. I threw a little editorial commentary in there, but you got the quote. All across America, people are being intimidated, threatened, and even killed by mostly men. And in many cases, I think these men who feel that they can't go anywhere without a gun stuck in their pants are trying to make up for their feelings of impotence by packing pistols. We license people to drive a car because cars can kill people. But most guns in most states don't require a license to buy or to own. And gun sellers, particularly at gun shows, they're not even as regulated as our car dealers. You know, we nail people who roll back odometers and then sell cars, but not people who sell guns to killers. And now the mayor of Tampa has asked Governor Rick Scott for permission to ban guns at the RNC convention. So Scott has said no. That RNC attendees should be able to protect themselves from the occupiers. Tampa's also passed a law making it illegal for the occupiers to carry weapons like more than 6 inches of string or squirt guns. So, you know, the question that I asked my last guest, that I asked Noel, I think this is This is a really interesting one. I mean, just consider the frame for a minute. Is the NRA going to be setting up a table at Occupy Tampa tomorrow so that they have time to get their permits processed and credit cards processed and they can buy their guns and they can get some firearms training and everything to arm the occupiers? Now, even the question, the absurdity of that question, shows how stupid, polarized, and most importantly, politicized the gun issue has become in America. I mean, the fact that like, as Noel said, well, the Occupy people are not the demographic of gun owners. Oh, really? I mean, the people who are saying everybody should have a gun because that's how we're going to stop crime are saying, but, you know, people who are advocating for good pay for workers and higher taxes on billionaires, they shouldn't have guns. They're not good Republicans. Do you get this? That all you have to do is present the frame, ask the question, and suddenly it snaps into focus how this has become a political issue and therefore has nothing to do with the founders of America, the Constitution, or even the rule of law. It has to do with politics. Is the NRA going to set up a table in Tampa for occupiers to register for, you know, gun safety courses and carry permits? You think?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And do we expect the occupiers to defend themselves against gun owners with that shoot first law down there in Florida? What do you think? Okay, a whole bunch of people want to share their thoughts on this, and I'm going to pick up your calls in just a second. But first, I have to tell you a news story and an incredible forehead slap that I got out of this. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals yesterday afternoon, ruled that when Jose Padilla was tortured for 3 years by the Bush administration, you know, turned into, described by his attorney and the people who saw him in court, a piece of furniture. He was such a vegetable, he was unwilling to talk to his own attorney because he was convinced that was just another trick. When Jose Padilla was tortured for those 3 years, as the result of a torture memo that was written by two guys, one of them is John Yoo, who's now teaching law at Berkeley, I believe, the Ninth Circuit Court ruled that he wasn't really tortured. That's what they ruled yesterday. And therefore, he couldn't sue John Yoo. Okay, so that's the news story. My aha on this was, wait a minute, who was the other guy who wrote the torture memos with John Yoo? It was a guy by the name of Jay Bybee. And what happened with Jay Bybee? Well, around 2007, I think it was, maybe 2008, in the last year or two of the Bush administration, George W. Bush put Jay Bybee on the Ninth Circuit Court, which just ruled that John Yoo cannot be prosecuted for helping set up torture because those things that were done to Jose Padilla didn't constitute torture. Tell me it doesn't get weirder than that, right? Chris in Chicago. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Oh, I called about the gun thing. I had
yep.
I had a
that's fine.
On that, but real quick on the whole war criminal thing. Obviously, the entire Bush administration, which I did not support, should have all been brought up on war crimes. But, you know, on the other side of the token, I'm not so happy with what the Obama administration is doing in regards to our criminality when it comes to war either.
Well, to his credit, President Obama has stopped torture. Stopped it on day one. So, but let's talk about gun owners here. You wanted to get into this Second Amendment thing.
Yeah, well, first of all, we can stop bombing people. And then second of all, maybe that would give us a reason to not have to be an armed society. Because right now we're bombing people all over this world. We're lathering the Middle East.
Are you really trying to suggest, Chris, that the reason that Americans are that there's 300 million guns in America is because we're all terrified of terrorists? To the best of my knowledge, there's only been one really significant terrorist attack.
The right and and the left media, Tom, does a really good job of stirring up the fear, no matter what angle it's coming from, and you're part of it. So let's get real here.
What?
The real reason of the
silence, Chris, I'm the guy out here saying the security theater at the airports is stupid, that the people who are going to protect us if there's a terrorist on the plane are the other passengers. I'm the
Absolutely.
Guy who says I don't even think we should have to pass through security to get on an airplane.
But
at the very
President
most,
Obama,
a magnetometer, like you have to pass through when you go hang out with the president.
You defend the NDAA. You defend our continuing bombing.
I am not defending any of those things, Chris, and that's not the point. I know that I got it. I've read the Republican talking points over on the GOP website about how to call into a talk show, and you know, be sure to say that you support the Obama administration, but to try to depress the possibility of the vote coming out. It's all right there. Jason in Winnipeg, Canada. Hey, Jason, what's up?
How's it going, Tom?
Fine. If you're on a speakerphone, if you could pick it up, it would be great, Jason. What's on your mind?
I just wanted to respond to the gentleman that you had on. I guess he was an NRA advocate or something like that. I didn't catch his title. But he had said that, by banning weapons in the public forum, you're not going to stop the lone nut. And I agree, you won't stop the lone nut. However, what you will do is open up the possibility to that, even the Gabby Gifford situation, for instance, or even the university shooting. If everyone did carry a weapon and they were all pulling it out trying to stop this guy, when the police got there, who would they shoot? They'd shoot everybody.
Yeah. And not only that, who would be dead by the time the police got there? There was a guy, and this is one of the stories that that is in this Huffington Post blog that I quoted earlier, or a link to it. This 75-year-old guy who works in a liquor store, I think it was down in Florida, and somebody robbed an unarmed guy, robbed him. He chases the guy out in the street with a gun, and takes a shot at the guy as the guy's getting in the van and driving off, misses. The bullet misses a car with a woman and her young daughter in it by less than an inch, goes through the window of a beauty shop, flies right by a woman's head, and lodges itself in the mirror right behind her. He could have killed three people, just trying to stop this one unarmed guy. And, I mean, people say, if everybody had guns or Gabby Giffords was, they probably would have killed the guy who was shooting. Well, maybe, but they probably would have killed 10 other people, too. It's like, that's why law enforcement officers, and I can tell you, I've been through some of the training in the Georgia Police Academy. It is rigorous. It's why most law enforcement officers in their entire careers never pull their service revolver and or discharge it. End of rant. Jason, do you guys have this problem in Canada?
We have a handgun ban in Canada. Every handgun is banned. So, again, you're not going to stop the criminals who want to have handguns.
No.
But there's no point to having a handgun. It really isn't. The only reason why you would have a handgun and carry it around is to cause harm to somebody. That's the only reason why you would have it. If you're a hunter, I get it. Go and hunt all day long as it's in season, you're not breaking any laws. Go and hunt all day long. But you don't need to carry a weapon around your city because you're not helping anybody.
If you're a recreational shooter, or if you think that it's a great sport, or you want to shoot on the rifle range competitively or something like that, any of that stuff, rifle or pistol, I don't have a problem with that. Or frankly, I don't have a problem with somebody carrying a weapon if they have a license. We give driver's licenses to people because cars can kill people. That's the only reason. Bicycles can't kill people. That's why they don't require you to get a license to drive a bicycle. But a car can kill somebody, and so can a gun. Anyhow, Jason, thank you for the call. Very well said. Jerry in Long Island, New York, listening to WWRL. Hey, Jerry, what's up?
Yeah, thank you very much. First of all, before I get to my question, I'd like to say I agree with the Canadian caller, and I think maybe we need to import some of Canada's common sense as a country regarding guns, because here are the two main questions I have. No right is absolute, and so if you cannot, NLT forcefully shall fire in a crowded theater, then why should anyone be allowed to carry a loaded gun or a loaded firearm of any type into a crowded convention? And also, why should the Second Amendment...
Well, they're not going to... Let me just correct you, Jerry. They are not going to be able to carry weapons into the convention. Because that's, as Noel correctly pointed out, that's going to be a federal security zone. But there will be... people coming out of that convention, going to hotels, going to bars, going to restaurants that are not in the security zone. You don't have to pass through security to get to them. People need to eat. People need to use the bathroom. People are going to go to other events. There's going to be cocktail parties and lobbyist parties and all kinds of stuff all over town. And all of that stuff is going to be going on. And that's going to be, a free fire zone, apparently. Thanks for the call, Jerry. Cindy in Olympia, Washington, listening on Talk 1090. Hey, Cindy. Cynthia, what's up?
Hi there.
Cindy.
Tom, I had to call on the gun issue, too. I take deference to what that idiot said about liberals and owning guns. My husband and I are longtime liberals. We used to hunt for food, although now we hunt more with a Kodak camera. But I am so sick and tired of the NRA having co-opted this country for the last 25 years.
Yeah.
It's just been horrendous. I mean, and I have to say I was once a member, and I made sure my girls had hunter safety. But there is just no way that we can allow this to continue. To be perfectly honest, you look at people on the streets nowadays and you wonder, are they packing heat? You're driving in the car and somebody gives you a dirty look. You're scared spitless. They might be packing a gun.
Yep.
And with these crazy stand your ground rules, I don't know about you, but I have no intention of visiting Florida or Arizona or any of those states that have that until we get some sanity back.
Yeah, there you go. Well said. Thank you very much, Cindy. Appreciate the call. Woody in Richfield Park, Arizona, watches on Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, Woody, what's up?
Just thought I'd share some thoughts. What we know what happened in Arizona with the Gabrielle Giffords shooting is that, we don't know that she was carrying her 9mm Glock that she kept handy, but we do know that two guys that tackled the shooter, Loeffler, were also armed. But they realized if they pulled out their weapon when he's shooting, they just become a target. And they didn't want to get killed because they knew it was safer. One of them was a trained police officer.
Wow.
It was safer to tackle him after he had to reload.
I didn't realize that. And or maybe I knew that at the time, and it's been some time. But, the point is, if you pull a weapon out and start discharging it in a crowded place, you may stop a crime. You may also kill two or three innocent people. It's not something that should be done. And the idea that somehow we're going to have a safer society, a more civil society, I've seen these bumper stickers for years. An armed society is a civil society, or an armed society is a polite society. Nonsense. An armed society is a testosterone-driven, terrified society is what it is.
Also, I wanted to get in that on the Sunday paper after the Gabrielle Giffords shooting, there was an article about a detective, undercover or not, plainclothes detective in Baltimore, who was shot by police officers showing up to a scene where he was returning fire to someone else. And they shot one of their own detectives.
Oh, my. Because they didn't realize he was a police officer and he had a gun out.
Yes.
Yeah. See, that's the problem. Woody, thanks so much. Some common sense here. It's amazing. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you. Do we really, is Rick Scott really serious about this?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
That the lobbyists and the hookers and the Republicans coming to Tampa need to arm themselves to protect themselves against the occupiers? Really? This portion of our program is brought to you by the new book, Where Did the Towers Go? Evidence of Directed Free Energy Technology on 9/11 by Dr. Judy Wood, a materials scientist and structural engineer. Go to wheredidthetowersgo.com for more information. Yeah, well, those people, they tend to have guns who are fighting the law, and you just, don't want to get in between them and the police, particularly with a gun in your hand, because they might think that you're one of them, and that's, that doesn't work out so well. Gary in New Leipzig, North Dakota, watching us on Free Speech TV on Dish Network. Hey, Gary, what's up?
Well, as a veteran, I ask a lot of veterans in combat zones what it's like to get guns in places they're at, and, they being Yemens, like our number two gun owners. And these coming back from Afghan were telling me that poverty keeps a lot of them from getting guns over there, but that for $25 you can get an AK-47, for $15 a hand grenade, for $30 an RPG. So I guess what I'm saying is there's guns and there's guns.
Yeah.
We may be more heavily armed, but we don't have those kind of weapons.
Yeah, we don't have rocket-propelled grenades. I'll give you that, and a good thing it is. But it raises a question. If you don't need, and nobody's asserting that we need a rocket-propelled grenade, why do you need a 50 millimeter rifle that'll shoot a 50 millimeter round? I mean, this—I just don't get this. I mean, it's, for that matter, I mean, you know, that's beyond hunting. You know, that's going to take out the whole shoulder of a deer. These high-powered rifles. Or why do you need a 30-round clip? It just makes no sense to me. Gary, thank you for the call thoughtful comment. Hack in Radon, Oklahoma, listening on Sirius XM. Hey, Hack, what's up?
Hello, Tom. Hey, Tom.
Yeah, you're in the air.
Yeah. Well, whenever one of these, well, for lack of a better term, gun nuts call again, ask them if they can recite the first clause of the Second Amendment. If they can, ask them to which militia they belong.
Right. Right. In order to maintain a well-regulated militia is the first clause, if my memory serves me right.
Yes. Additionally, remind them that they are subordinate to the President of the United States, according to Article 2, Section 2.
Oh, the militia of the United States is subordinate to the President. Yes, you're right.
Militia of the several states. Yep.
The militia of the several states. Yep. And so, wow. You know, when you put it together like that, I just wonder how things like the Miller case was the Supreme Court case where the Supreme Court decided that there was an individual right to own a gun in the United States. And
That was upheld in Chicago, I believe.
Yeah, yeah. And you wonder how that happened. I mean, nobody bothered, apparently, to read the debates during the Constitutional Convention. Nobody bothered to read the Pennsylvania State Constitution, on which has had at the time, no longer has, but... This was when Pennsylvania was an independent commonwealth and before the United States was a nation. But Pennsylvania at that time in their constitution said there shall be no standing armies during time of peace. Standing armies being a peculiar, I'm trying to do this from memory, a peculiar affliction upon democratic societies, or words to that effect. You know, in other words, a standing army during time of peace will be up to no good. They get up to mischief. And guess what? It's called the military-industrial complex here in the United States. And then they said basically a standing army would be instead you would have a citizens' militia, and in order to maintain a well-regulated militia, the right of citizens to own guns shall not be abridged. So very, very straightforward. Yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of Pennsylvania, Tom, still there?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, speaking of Pennsylvania, Rachel was talking to a state senator there, a state representative, I believe, a couple of years ago when the NRA had their convention in Pittsburgh.
Huh.
About how he was trying to get guns banned in a suburb of Pittsburgh. I think it's called Homewood.
Right.
And, Corbett shot it down.
Who is this?
I forget his name. He's a state senator
Okay.
He's a state representative from the Pittsburgh area.
Okay, got it. Mac, thank you very much. I appreciate the call. John in Laguna Vista, Texas. Hey, John, what's up? Thanks for listening to Sirius.
I've got a question for you. I always thought that we should have a federal government mandate insurance for gun owners. It only affect gun owners, and let the insurance companies decide who they think is qualified to own one or not.
That is brilliant.
They'll get interested in the legislative process. And if somebody comes out and fires off a round at somebody unarmed, like you were talking about, and they kill somebody in a beauty shop, that family is going to be able to sue that insurance company and make a claim.
You're absolutely right. And in fact, the presence of the insurance makes the litigation even more probable. And that's absolutely brilliant. If we can say, okay, that you have to be licensed to drive a car because cars can kill people. And you also have to have insurance to drive a car because cars can kill people, and they can do a lot of other kinds of damage. Guns can kill people. Guns can do a lot of kinds of damage. So, yes, you have an absolute right to own a gun, but you don't have a right to own a gun without insurance. Or you have a right to own a gun without insurance, but we have the right to penalize you and force you to buy the insurance, or buy the insurance for you and charge you for it on your taxes or whatever. I mean, we're now getting into individual mandate territory, but there's a variety of ways it could be done. And you're right. The insurance companies would then start paying very, very careful attention to who has these guns, and we'd have a whole lot fewer wackadoodles, and the gun show loophole would be done away with immediately. That is absolutely brilliant, John. Thank you very much for the call. Don in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, listening on Sirius. Hey, Don, I got a minute to the break. What's up?
Well, have a question, sir. Do you own life insurance?
I don't know if I do or not, actually.
Do you own car insurance?
No, I don't. I don't own a car.
Okay. Well, if you own life insurance, you wouldn't be planning on dying today. And if you own car insurance, you wouldn't be planning on wrecking your car today. Okay? I am a concealed carry permit holder. Whenever I leave my residence, I am armed. I have no intention of using the pistol that I carry.
You're trying to assert that your gun is insurance. You could easily make that claim of a knife or pepper spray or... becoming a black belt or whatever.
Ensure my ability to come home in one piece.
Yeah, but the fact of the matter is, Don, if you look at the statistics, you're more likely to kill yourself with that gun than you are to kill another person. You're more likely to kill yourself than you are to stop a crime, and you're more likely to have a child in your home kill themselves or kill another child than to stop a crime.
Okay, here's a statistic you need to look at.
Quick, I'm listening. I guess not. Okay. Next, I'll tell you about a new corporation in town that carries a lot more weight in Washington than any other corporation you ever heard of, ever.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. This afternoon, I want to tell you about a new corporation in town that carries a lot more weight here in Washington, D.C. than any other corporation you've ever heard of. This is a corporation responsible for the current makeup of our Supreme Court, for the balance of power in our legislative branch, and up until 3 years ago, it was even responsible for the occupant in our White House. It's a massive corporation, stretches all across 50 states, and even has politicians in every state who have sworn allegiance to it. Not even the Koch brothers can claim that accomplishment. It's a giant corporation that has its own wildly popular cable TV network to sell its products and boost its PR. It's a corporation that's spun off hundreds of subsidiaries all around the nation to keep revenue flowing in, thus maximizing the profits of its allies or to take down its enemies. It's a corporation that can take our nation to war if it so chooses, or condemn tens of millions of Americans to poverty, or kick hundreds of millions of Americans out of their health insurance plans if it believes that that's the most profitable thing to do. It's a corporation that's so big and influential, in large part because its functional shareholders, its stakeholders, are mostly other corporations, along with some of the richest people in America who mostly either made their money using the corporate form or inherited it from parents who used corporations. And when this corporation succeeds in selling its products, which oddly are human beings who have sworn loyalty to the corporation, that's the product it sells, all the stakeholders in this corporation stand to make massive profits for their own respective corporations. This is basically the capo di capo, the corporation of corporations. You could call it the front corporation for corporate America. So what is it? What is this all-powerful corporation that has a stranglehold on our government? What is this corporation so powerful it can even spit on Betsy Ross and turn the stars from our flag upside down on its logo? It's the Republican Party, Inc. Think about it. The Republican Party, is it really a legitimate political party in America anymore? Or has it just become a corporate shill? Like a corporation, the Republican Party is only focused on maximizing profits for its stakeholders, or what we call donors. And those donors are not average Americans who give $50 like used to happen in the old days. Instead, those donors are corporations, millionaires, and billionaires like the Koch brothers, Foster Freeze, and Shelley Adelson, who form corporate super PACs to funnel unlimited amounts of money into the Republican Party Corporation to sell more politicians to voters around the nation. Republicans have raised 8 times more money through super PACs than Democrats. And Karl Rove and the Koch brothers have pledged to put even more hundreds of millions of dollars to defeat Democrats into this election cycle coming up over the next 8 months or so. The Republican Party, like any good corporation, gladly takes multi-million dollar investments from other corporations and from millionaires and billionaires, and then compliantly hands back to those investors, as a return on their investment, laws that cut their taxes and increase their profits. In fact, millionaires are responsible for 57% of all super PAC investments, donations, so far this election cycle. And those super PACs did so well for Republicans in 2010, catapulting them to huge electoral victories. They even got control of the House of Representatives. And now, just like a corporation, Republican Party Inc. is working to maximize profit for its stakeholders. That means filibustering tax increases on their Romney super-rich donors. It means passing budgets that preserve billions in taxpayer subsidies for the oil baron donors. It means working to defund Wall Street regulations that might cut into the profits of their bankster donors. It means repealing Obamacare and Medicare to make their for-profit health insurance donors happy. Republican Party Inc. is using the perfect corporate model. It brings in rich investors, uses their money to help sell its products, which are politicians. And the more politicians that are sold to the American people, then the more profitable Republican Party Inc. and its investors become. Following this logic, Republican Party Inc. is not interested in attracting broad-based support like a traditional political party, or building a platform that's going to resonate with people who aren't members of corporate America. I mean, they bring along the useful idiots by throwing out things like be afraid of the gays and look out for those brown people and duck, there's a terrorist, you know, that kind of stuff. But they know, they're just bringing them along for the ride. Those are not the people that they actually invite to the events. They're really just interested in the profits, just like a corporation. And also just like a corporation, they don't give a damn about democracy. Small D democracy. Hence Republican Party Inc.'s efforts to pass voter ID laws that will kick millions of Democratic voters off the polls ahead of the next election. Plain and simple. Plain and simple. The Republican Party is no more a legitimate political party than the mafia is a legitimate social club. Proof of this, I mean, just look at Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney came out today. He was given this, touting his flag thing, right? He's talking about his flag thing. And, Jacob, I think that you can play.
We've seen that
on this computer.
Times.
Right.
I had the occasion, as you perhaps know, of helping organize the Olympic Winter Games of 2002. And following 9/11 and that great tragedy, which was just prior to our games, one of the people in our team said, why don't we create an Olympic pin which says United We Stand on it and has a symbol of a flag. And this obviously is not a new idea. Everybody else in the country was doing the same thing. But we thought it was a new idea at the time. And so we created a little pin, and we notified people in the community that we were now going to be selling these pins, and the proceeds would go to the families of victims of the tragedy. And we identified that we're thank you. We identified where we're going to be selling these, and we wondered if people would show up to buy these pins. And we announced it, and then I just remember that morning after it was announced, going downstairs. We were in a big, tall skyscraper.
As billionaires usually are.
Salt Lake City.
Are, you know.
Went downstairs to go over, I think it was the building next door where they were selling these pins. Went outside,
in
and
slums.
There was a line around the block, all the way down the street. People stood in line for, as I recall, well over an hour just to be able to buy a little pin.
And isn't that a heartwarming story? Mitt Romney came up with the idea to sell a pin. Well, but just like Bain Financial, you know, with so many of their companies, they had their pin made in China. And not only that, on the conference call yesterday that was hosted by the Republican National Committee to attack President Obama for high unemployment, they have, you know, the RNC, they have these regular conference calls where they invite members of the press to come in. And you dial a number to get into the conference call and a special code, you know, and you have to get this in email these days, or by phone call. And so, you know, it's kind of an exclusive group. Lynn Sweet of the Chicago Sun-Times was one of the reporters who was invited, and she pointed out that the conference call was hosted. Now, this is Mitt Romney attacking President Obama for high unemployment. It was hosted out of the Philippines by a company in the Philippines, a subcontractor to Verizon. So all these reporters from all over the country were dialing into the Philippines. They didn't realize that they were calling an 800 number, dialing into the Philippines where they were, you know, being connected by operators there to the Mitt Romney campaign so that Mitt Romney could attack Barack Obama for high unemployment. And then Romney comes out and brags about his pins made in China. Now, I'm willing to cut Romney a little slack on the pins made in China because there may not be any pins companies left in the United States. I mean, there's some things that we just don't make here anymore. But at least you should stand up and talk about the insanity of the trade policy that brought about that situation.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, Republican Party, Inc. Is the Republican Party a legitimate political party? Or is it time to just say, you know, let's bring back the Whigs?
I'll show you just how cool scientists are. We study everything, that's why we're cool. And yes, most of us got high marks in school. And proud. Paleoanthropology.
Okay, just a three-minute interruption here for our program with my geeky science for the week. This is the Thursday afternoon second segment. Of the second hour is my 3 minutes to talk about one of my favorite topics, in addition to politics, is science. And this new study, this just came out actually about 4 days ago. Pigeons, the headline, pigeons create GPS from Earth's magnetic field. Certain neurons in pigeon brains encode the direction and intensity of Earth's magnetic fields. This was published in Science Express. And what they found was that the pigeons have cells. I thought this was particularly interesting, that they're not just in their brains. They're in their eye retina, in their nose, in their inner ear, and their beak. So their brain is getting feedback, and you know, the nose, they're getting olfactory feedback, so they're smelling the longitude and latitude lines, direction lines. Their eyes, they're seeing them. Their beak, they're feeling them or tasting them. Their inner ear, they've got a sense of balance. They can feel themselves sliding along the magnetic lines of the earth. Isn't that amazing? They actually, the way that they found this out is they put these pigeons, they, you know, wired them up to super brain scanners and then put them in a box where, a large one, you know, a room-sized box, where they could put such a massive magnetic field around it that they could create an alternative earth magnetic field, and they would do that, move it around, and the pigeons' brains moved, you know, and all these cells responded to it. I think, frankly, it's not just pigeons. Now, we know that there are a lot of other, you know, from insects, bees, and things like that, that also have this. I think people do. I have an incredibly good sense of direction. You can take me almost anywhere, spin me around a circle, let me stop, and within a few seconds, once my brain orients, I can tell you which direction is north. Some people can't. You know, Louise has always been really confused about directions. She's really good on a lot of things, but knowing which way is north, not her strong suit. I'm really dumb about a lot of things Louise is really smart about, but I always know which way north is. And I think that, you know, for me as a little kid, I used to, you know, I had these Davy Crockett phase that you all go through and your boys go through when they're 7 years old. And I was, you know, and I used to spend a lot of time in the woods. And I had to learn how to, you know, where north was. And I think you just learn it. So anyway, that's our geeky science for the day. I think it's probably in all animals, but who knows? Okay, we've got guns on the table. Well, not literally, no guns here, but we've been talking about that. And we have a question: is the Republican Party a legitimate political party? We have, a lot of other things in the news today. I mentioned Jay Bybee's on the Ninth Circuit Court, which just, now he was not one of the three judges who ruled in this case, but he's on the court that just ruled that John Yoo, Jay Bybee's partner in crime at the White House, the Bush White House, did not commit war crimes, did not actually authorize torture when they authorized torture, which is bizarre. The Ninth Circuit is usually considered the liberal court. Not so much anymore. And a lot going on. Religious groups in California are saying raising taxes on the rich is the moral thing to do. Jerry Brown wants to, instead of cutting schools and health care for poor people and working people, Jerry Brown wants to raise taxes on people making over $250,000 a year. 60% of Californians agree with him. Looks like it's going to make the ballot. So a lot going on. Samuel in Petaluma. Speaking of California, Samuel in Petaluma, it says you disagree with me. What's up?
Well, you're great on the Republican Party, and the pigeons. When we have a reversal of the polls, they could all get lost, which would probably be
or they'll all end up in South America.
I mean, a major blessing, but to the extent that the Bill of Rights was written to prohibit the federal government from interfering with our basic rights, I think you get it wrong. The federal government still is prohibited from any activity. And whereas all adult males were seen as part of the militia, every adult male should have a weapon, according to that the Bill of Rights, or should be entitled to.
Well, every adult male who is a member of the militia.
All the adult males were viewed as part of the militia.
Well, no, they specifically excluded felons. They excluded,
well, yeah.
You know, they excluded, there were people of certain races who were excluded. There were certain people of certain ages. Well, you said adult, okay.
Yeah, that was determined by the individual states, and when the
let me pose a question to you, Samuel.
Declared, he could call them up.
No, I get it, and that's how it works in Switzerland today, and that's how it works in Israel and a bunch of other countries. And
no, it's not how it works today. They've renamed the militia the National Guard, and without a declaration of war, they unconstitutionally call them up.
Yes,
I would just love to see one governor simply say no. The militias are the state. People, and until you declare war, you can't have our militia.
Yeah. Well, there were attempts to do that during the Vietnam War and during the Iraq War. There was talk about an attempt to do that, and
one governor didn't have the guts.
Yeah, it didn't go far. It didn't go far enough. I'm with you, Samuel. And it's also why we need to not have a standing army during times of peace.
Militia is not a standing army.
That's right.
Army is like we have a standing navy according to the Constitution.
That's right. The Constitution says allowed. That's right. A navy is allowed, and in fact, a navy is necessary to protect our borders.
But if the anti-gun nuts wanted to actually do something that's constitutional, they would simply have the states say that the militia's weapons will all be longer than 18 inches. And therefore eliminate all pistols from being protected.
Yeah, or they shall all be longer than 4 feet. And, you know, so everybody in the militia has an RPG, but they don't, you know, actually that's a stretch. Here's the other thing, though, is just because we did it in 1789, I mean, the Constitution also authorized white people to own black people. Just because we did it in 1889, does that mean, or 1789, does that mean that we should still be doing it?
Well, we should change the Constitution like they did with the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment.
I don't think we have to change the Constitution. I don't believe that the Second Amendment actually says that there is an undifferentiated, individualized right to own a weapon and do so in a way without restriction. I think that it means exactly what it says, in order to maintain a well-regulated militia. But that's just me. Samuel, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Oh, and by the way, you know why those pigeons had such a great sense of direction? They're robots from the planet Xenu! Forgot to tell you that part. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And, oh, this is incredible. In the United States Senate a week or so ago, the Violence Against Women Act, this is something that has been routinely, you know, renewed every year after year. And they tweak it and fine-tune it, you know, from time to time, if what was a fine thing to do. But it's routinely renewed. George W. Bush signed it in 2005.
Oh, great piece of legislation. Yeah, I'm proud to do it. Yeah, so can I have violence against women? No.
And no, I'm not going to go down that road about George Bush's history. Anyhow, George Bush signed it. It has come up for renewal. And the Democrats,
how dare they,
added to it specifically that it would protect. Well, actually, you know, I'm not even sure that they added anything to it. Because, the, you know, this news story by Annie Rose Strasser over at Think Progress Justice, the Violence Against Women Act is facing another struggle to stay intact. So this is just, this is the legislation. What the Republicans want to do is they want to strip out of it three groups of women that they think it's okay to have violence against. And that would be gay women, lesbians, immigrant women, presumably immigrant women, people who are undocumented, and Native American women. How dare they be occupying this country that God gave to us? Republican mantra, right? It's like, you know, why did Saudi Arabia end up on that land that God gave us, you know, for all that oil? How come Saddam Hussein ended up with our oil? Those kind of things. Anyhow, so they want to strip out. So in the Senate, they tried. And they failed because all of the Democrats voted for it. The Democrats have a majority in the Senate. And to overcome a Republican filibuster, all they needed was three or four or five Republican senators to say, this is crazy. You want to deny violence protections to women because they're lesbians? You want to deny violence protection to women because they're immigrants, because they're Native Americans? That's nuts. So it passed the Senate, which is controlled by the Democrats. But now it's in the House of Representatives, which is controlled by the Republicans. And it looks like the Republicans in the House are going to do this. The House bill, they've already put the bill together, and the lead sponsor, Representative Sandy Adams, Republican from Florida. The House bill would eliminate Senate language that supporters say would do more to help victims of domestic violence, including gays and lesbians, immigrants, and American Indians. Adams considers those provisions unnecessary, as spokeswoman said. Right. Amazing. By the way, if you're in Portland, if you're listening to us on KPOJ or any of the other ways that you can listen in Portland, but especially, you know, a special shout out to KPOJ. Tomorrow night, Friday night. Thank you, Louise. Tomorrow night, Friday, May 4th, or afternoon, a reception from 4:30 to 6:30. If you hear Ellen Ratner on the show all the time, you want to meet her in person and see a movie called A Force of Nature, which is about Ellen. She is a force of nature, this woman, I got to tell you. And it's going to be playing, there's a reception from 4:30 to 6:30. The movie's at 7:30. Ellen Ratner is going to be there. You can meet her. It's a night with Barbara Koppel and Ellen Ratner. And it's the Portland, Oregon Women's Film Festival, the POW Fest. And it's going to be at the Hollywood Theater. That's at 4122 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. So check that out. It is ticket sales benefit the POW Fest, the Hollywood Theater, and Goats for the Old Goat, which is Ellen's organization to help out people in South Sudan. And you're going to love it if you're in Portland. It's just really, really worth it. And my old friend Carl Wolfson, who is the host of the Carl in the Morning Show on AM 620 KPOJ, is going to be the moderator for the live Q&A. So you don't have to be a woman to go. Everybody is welcome. And it's tomorrow night. It's tomorrow afternoon from 4:30 to 6:30, at Magnolia's Corner, the reception. And then the screening is at the Hollywood Theater at 7:30, which is on Sandy Boulevard. You can track that down. So just a heads up. An unpaid announcement for my friend Ellen. She is incredible. Okay, Tom in Tomahawk, Wisconsin. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Good.
You know, in the 7,000-year history of governance, there is no government that ever wanted an armed populace. And it was so revolutionary in the Second Amendment to put in the Second Amendment because they know that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And it's the most dangerous form of bullying when you have a protected population.
Well, it's a nice theory, but the fact of the matter is, Tom, you're wrong. The history of modern civilization and even pre-civilization is that most people did have weapons. Most people had, and you know, long before there were guns and sophisticated things like that, people had knives, people had clubs, people had tomahawks, people had stones, people had, you know, people have always had weapons. And you're assuming that the way that we prevent tyranny is by having an armed populace. That worked out real well with the Civil War, right?
Well, it's not working out real well in Syria right now, with 9,000 being murdered, and in the continent of Africa, where people are just aimlessly and randomly being executed, and they aren't bad.
Where people are very well armed in these countries. I mean, if you're talking about Sudan, they just fought a civil war. I was there, and there's weapons everywhere. They are so plentiful. They are so available. And you know, it's not stopping tyrannical governments. Are you really trying to tell me that your ability to own a Saturday Night Special 38 is going to stop the United States government from flipping into some fascist form? You really think so?
There are more weapons available than 38 specials.
Well, whatever. I mean, there's 300 million guns in America. Do you really think that if every, you know, and now four-fifths of us don't own guns, average gun owner apparently owns four or five, but do you really think that if everyone had a gun, that suddenly that they, you know, if, I mean, have you seen a riot action recently? Have you seen what the police look like when they go into military mode?
I have.
And that's not the military.
We are the military, though, Tom. We are the military.
Well, in theory. In theory,
well, we're supposed to be the military.
You know, we're supposed to be, but I'm just saying, Tom. A, the founders did not want us to be armed so that we could protect ourselves against the government that the founders created. In fact, there was no discussion of that. I defy you to find
the oppression from Great Britain that didn't have anything to do with the Second Amendment. All the oppression.
Great Britain was not the government that we were forming. I defy you to find anywhere in the Constitutional Convention dialogues, and James Madison published them in 1838, and are in print now. You can probably download them. I'm sure you can download them for free on the web because they're copyright free, and probably do a fairly quick search, even a keyword search. You will not find a discussion in there. I've read much of them. And you will not find a discussion in there about, hey, let's arm the populace because our own government might go nuts. They never had that conversation.
It was only about religious oppression then in Great Britain.
I beg your pardon?
It was only about religious oppression in Great Britain then.
No, it was actually economic. The Boston Tea Party in November of 1773 was in response to the Tea Act. The Tea Act was the biggest tax cut the country of Great Britain had ever given a corporation in its history. It gave what in today's dollars would be almost a $500 million tax cut to the British East India Company, specifically on tea, so that the East India Company could take this tea and bring it into North America and undercut all of the small tea companies. They could pull a Walmart and basically take over from the entire eastern seaboard, you know, all the way from southern Georgia all the way up to New Hampshire, that they could take, or Maine rather, they could take over all the tea business. And the small tea sellers and the small bar owners who sold tea as well as beer, and you know, people like Paul or Sam Adams and whatnot, they said, to hell with that. You know, we're not going to be Walmartized. And they went out and they committed a $1 million act of vandalism against the East India Company, against the company, not against the government, against the company. And then the government, after that, the government of the United Kingdom said, okay, now, Boston, you have to pay back the East India Company, not us, not the British. You have to pay back the East India Company that $1 million in today's dollars. And that was called the Boston Ports Act, which was passed in early 1774. And the good citizens of Boston said, screw you to King George III. And so they blockaded Boston Harbor. And that was the beginning of the whole thing. That was the point at which Thomas Jefferson stopped talking about being good citizens of British America and started talking about the United States of America. And you know, yeah, we fought a war against the British. But again, I tell you, these guys who fought this war and who created the founding documents and the Constitution, they never envisioned that our own citizens would fight against ourselves. They prayed it would never happen. Come to Washington, D.C., and on the Washington Memorial, on the Jefferson Memorial, you can read a fragment of a letter that Thomas Jefferson wrote in 1828. And I forget who he wrote it to, but in 1828, he wrote this letter. He was talking about the Missouri Compromise and how slavery had not been eradicated. And he said, I weep for my country. He said, my only solace is that I will not be here to see. You know, he said, he was just a year and a half before he died, or 2 years before he died. And he said, I'm soon to be in this bark to that far shore. In other words, the canoe across the river Hades or whatever. And he said, I will not be alive to see this error over slavery. But he saw the Civil War coming, and it didn't work out so well.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We do not have guns to protect ourselves against the government. We have the ballot box for that. We are the government.
This is a union town, a union town. All down the line, this is a union town, a union town.
Welcome back to the place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, not a chance. No way. Don't even think about it. Mark Pocan is going to be with us at the top of the next hour, by the way. He's an amazing guy. This is a progressive Democrat. He's a state legislator. You know, ALEC is all about for state legislators. This is how they do their hustle. It's how they've run under the radar for 30 years now. The American Legislative Exchange Council. And they get together state legislators and lobbyists for various companies and industries, and they sit them one-on-one. I mean, it's a one-to-one ratio, right? And the lobbyists pay $50,000 to sit there, and the legislator pays a $100 fee to be there. And some states, I mean, I think it was Virginia the other day, it came out that Virginia had spent over $200,000 sending its mostly Republican legislators to these ALEC meetings. And most of them are Republicans. There's a few conservative Democrats, but the Democrats are starting to drop like flies because even the conservative Democrats don't really want to be associated with ALEC anymore. And it's just showing the stripes that it's, you'll recall, I opened this hour with my rant about it's Republican Party Inc. And so anyhow, that's the American Legislative Exchange Council and what they're up to. Is just, well, enough said. Let me get some of your calls in here. Kay in Mechanicsburg, Pennsylvania. Hey, Kay, what's up?
Oh, hey, Tom. Well, I'm sitting here and you're making me think, and I've got your book, Rebooting the American Dream, and wait a minute, the one about unequal protection.
Mm-hmm.
That was really important because for me, that was how I could explain to people how corporations or people came to be.
Yeah.
You know, and people don't know. And it really takes too much work. It takes a lot of work to get the truth these days.
It does.
And, you know, what I get frustrated about is, like, you know, science. Nobody wants they've made science, you know, questionable. I mean, not in my mind. But you know, and facts are questionable. I had one woman when I told her, I asked her a simple question about race. You know, what's the population, what's the percentage of African Americans in this country? And she said 50%. I live in South Central PA, and that's what they think.
Wow.
And so when I tell her 12%, and she said, well, where did you get those stats? From the census. Well, I don't believe the census. I don't know where you go with that. Somebody
and,
said, you know.
You know, aliens from space are, you know, running our government, and Bill Clinton zips on his lizard suit and, you know, or zips out of it or whatever. And
it just makes me crazy. But, like, what I caught about it, I was in the car listening to you on Sirius, and then I have Free Speech TV, so I'm, like, so happy.
Mm-hmm.
But I was listening to you about the guns, and here's where I get crazy on the guns, you know. My brother, he has them. He collects them. And when my husband, I'm fourth generation military, born in Charleston Air Force Base, married a man in the military who retired. We've got 3 out of 6 kids joined the military. One's in Afghanistan now. One just got back from South Korea. And 3 grandkids in the military. And they're all enlisted.
Right.
Right. And, you know, even my husband enlisted during Vietnam, not drafted. So, you know, when I hear all these people about wanting their Second Amendment rights with guns, and then I also hear these same people saying we need to attack Iran, I'm like, join the friggin' military and help out the other 1% who last month there were 28 active duty suicides.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's
a tragedy. It is. These are the chicken hawks, Kay. The people like Limbaugh and Hannity and whatnot who are so gung ho for war, but when their opportunity came along, they were busy. Dick Cheney, you know, five deferments.
I had better things to do.
Yeah.
You know, look, I'm a political junkie, and you know when I became active, because I'll tell you, you know, I was born on military, you know, so when 9/11 happened. And I listened to George Bush, and I didn't like how he got elected. I thought that was a little hinky. But,
just a little,
when he made his speech, you know, about the yellow, you know what I'm talking about, mm-hmm. uranium or whatever.
Yeah, yellow cake uranium, yeah.
Yeah, there you go. I listened to him, you know, and I mean, I said that because it was very important, because as soon as 9/11 happened, everybody around me said, we're going to war. All right. And, you know, my husband, he was in a National Guard unit. He was working active duty for the National Guard, doing things around the state. And then when they activated him, but anyway, I listened to Bush and I believed him, Tom. Mm-hmm. You know, I believed him because he's our commander in chief, right? You know, because I don't know. People that don't grow up in the military, they have no idea. It's like it's another culture, and there's a lot of pride, and there's a lot of sacrifice. And I believed this man, and to tell you how it hurts. And then my husband's National Guard unit got activated for Ramadi,
right?
You know, and people, I would walk around here and I would say, do you know how many people have died in this war? I mean, that's like, tell me it's an agitator, because people don't want to talk about it, don't want to think about it.
Kate, you have made your point really, really well. If there's a final point you want to make, but I do want to get some more callers in here, if you don't mind.
No, I don't mind, but and the tax thing, I'm so with you.
Okay, thank you very much, Kay. I appreciate it, and thank you for the call. Craig in Des Moines, Iowa. We got a minute to the break. Craig, what's up?
Oh, I was just thinking these laws that have been passing, the Stand Your Ground Law and the Terrorist or the Defense Act,
mm-hmm.
where they can declare any American a terrorist.
Yeah,
that they'll use these laws to get off people that shoot demonstrators, especially Occupy.
I don't follow your logic, but you know, I have some real concerns about some of the laws that have been passed since 9/11 and some of the general hysteria. I think this whole country is still locked in that fear. I think it's slowly diminishing. I think we saw in the United Kingdom, after, you know, when the Irish Republican Army was doing their bombing campaigns, there were some overstepping of civil liberties, which probably echo to this day. And but, you know, eventually people come to their senses, and I really believe the United States will too. I was on this rant about the American Legislative Exchange Council. Alec and Mark Pocan, who's coming up next, is a state representative who infiltrated Alex, a progressive Democrat, infiltrated Alex when they figured out that he wasn't a right-wing wackadoodle. They, even though he'd paid his $100 fee, they hustled him out the door. It is a hoot of a story and really kind of a sad commentary on what's going on in America. Coming up next, stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
This is just amazing. The American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, founded by Paul Weyrich, by the way. Jacob, pull that up if you don't mind. Paul Weyrich was back in 1980, he was one of Reagan's senior advisors. He was a young man at that time. And helped found the Heritage Foundation, was instrumental in the founding of the Cato Institute, I believe, and was the co-founder of the American Legislative Exchange Council. And here's just a brief little snippet from a speech that Paul Weyrich, the founder of ALEC, gave to a group of Christian Republicans, Republican activists, in 1980.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome, good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
So that's the founder of ALEC, and true to form and quite consistent, ALEC has been out there pushing legislation to make it harder for people to vote. Surprise, surprise. And they're actually having some significant success on that in states like Wisconsin. On the line with us is State Representative Mark Pocan. He is a Wisconsin state representative. His website, Pocan, P-O-C-A-N, 4FORCongress.com. And State Representative Pocan, welcome back to our program.
Oh, thank you, Tom. Appreciate it.
It is so good to have you with us, Pocan for Congress. Are you running for the U.S. Congress?
Yeah, Tammy Baldwin, our congressperson, who's been fantastic, is running for the U.S. Senate. And, you know, I've been in the legislature 14 years, fighting a lot of progressive battles for 14 years, and I think it's time to take it to the federal level. So I'm running for Congress, and
how cool is that?
Hoping to get elected by the people in this area.
Are you post-primary now?
No, we have a primary in August.
Okay, well, as soon as the primary shakes out, let me know. After the primaries, we get candidates on, and we push them really hard, but... I'm good on you for running for higher office. You are now, the last time you came on this program, you had just been hustled out of the room. Was it in New Orleans at the ALEC meeting?
Yeah, I think a couple times ago when we talked, I was actually at the convention and I was doing an interview with you, and they had staff following me around, and I had to walk the entire interview through the hotel so that I could actually have a conversation.
We were spying on ALEC, or at least you were, and although you weren't really spying because you paid your $100 to be there, right?
Yeah, years ago, I noticed in the legislature there were a lot of bad bills that came up that had nothing to do with the public good. They usually profited an out-of-state corporation and very quickly learned about ALEC. And I went to a conference about 4.5 years ago to try to expose a little more about them. I get the model legislation. You had a special password to get that, and I shared that with a lot of progressive groups so we knew what they were up to. And then this past summer, Matt Rothschild from the Progressive said, how would you like to go back to ALEC? And, you know, August, New Orleans, ALEC. It sounded like a dream vacation to me. So I went down there and watched, again, in operation, especially this year. Tom, as you know, they've been so successful in so many states because we have Republican majority in so many state houses. They've been overreaching, and they've just been at the forefront of a lot of activity. So it was good to be there, but also good to know what they're up to and be able to report on it.
All right. So you were able to see firsthand lobbyists for particular industries sitting side by side with mostly Republican state legislators, working out the details of and voting on whether or not to bring to various state governments for introduction pieces of legislation ranging from things that would knock Democrats off the voting rolls to things that would bust unions to, you know, things that would protect the Koch brothers' refineries from having to spend a little more money to clean up the air.
And anti-consumer legislation, things to privatize education. I mean, you name it. If it's a bad idea that's about corporate profit, I guarantee it's an ALEC bill.
Yeah. And now the it's Public Citizen, isn't it? Yeah. No, it's Common Cause.
Common Cause
has come out and sued ALEC, saying that under their nonprofit status, for their nonprofit status, they had to swear that not more than 20% of their activity involved lobbying, trying to modify legislation or pass legislation or get. You are now the first elected official and the first ALEC member, if I have this right, correct me if I'm wrong, to come out and publicly say to the Internal Revenue Service, yes, you should be investigating ALEC because I've been there, I've seen it, and more than 20% of what they're doing is certainly lobbying.
Absolutely. In fact, I would say from my observations, and I've been a member for a number of years now in order to watch this organization, 90%, I would guess, is about what they do is lobbying. You know, they write model legislation. They lobby you to introduce it in your states. They give you skills on how to get it passed. Everything that defines a lobbyist in Wisconsin is what ALEC does. And to say that they only have 20% so that they can have nonprofit status so the corporations can deduct the donations they give to ALEC, it's really a scam. And it's a scam that produces a lot of bad legislation. And, you know, we just wanted to be able to blow the whistle. And officially as a member, I asked ALEC to explain it to me. And of course, they ignored me as the only legislative member. If I was a Koch brother, I'm sure they would have jumped to it. But the fact that they didn't respond back to me, I decided to finally just go to the IRS and raise the issue directly with them.
So Common Cause, their petition, you, your petition, any feedback from the IRS?
We just put the request out, so nothing yet. But, you know, I do hope they look at it because, you know, obviously they're very serious about how the 501c3 status is out there. And, you know, when you violate that 20%, you're really not a nonprofit. You know, ALEC, everything about them violates that. They're not out there just providing information and what a normal nonprofit does. I mean, this is a corporate group that goes out there to lobby for legislation, tell you how to pass it. I mean, all the skills that I see in lobbyists. So, you know, I know that I and legislators in Arizona and I believe New Hampshire and Minnesota and other states have introduced bills, ALEC accountability bills, to actually make them have to register under our lobby laws. is. Mm-hmm. So it finally came to me. I mean, everything I've been saying about them is they're a lobbying organization, and when we saw what the Common Cause did, we're like, this is time to actually formally put the complaint in as a member, because that's what they do.
Now, my recollection, we're talking with Mark Pocan. He is a state representative in the state of Wisconsin, an ALEC member for 4 years, a progressive Democrat, which sounds like a contradiction in terms, but he's been kind of the guy on the inside who's been telling us on the outside what's going on in there. And he's also running for Congress, PocanForCongress.com, that website. Representative Pocan, my recollection is that on this show, we talked with you right after you had been thrown out of something at ALEC. Did they actually, you know, bounce you out?
Yeah, what happened is, you know, you go to the conference, and everything that's on the agenda, they have to let me go to, right? Because they are a 501c3. They have to let me be a member if I pay my dues. And so I could go to those things for the most part all right. However, all the real work happens at night when they schmooze the lobbyists and the corporations, wine and dine and throw parties for the conservative legislators who are then going to introduce their legislation. And there you have to get invited by your state party, the official delegation person from the legislature, who of course knew who I was. So I was kind of the loneliest guy in New Orleans that week when I was down there, but I did acquire one party invite, and I went to it, crashed it. They were going around with silver platters of cigars being handed out, and literally I wasn't there for 5 minutes, and I was approached by an ALEC staffer who said, "Do you have an invite to be here?" And I said, "Yes," and he said, "Did you show it at the door?" Because he knew that I physically should never have been able to have gotten an invite to this. So, you know, this is the scary part, is they like to operate in the shadows. And, you know, just like in a room, a dark room, when you turn the light on and watch the cockroaches scatter, that's exactly what happens with ALEC. When we start to expose them for what they are and you get a chance to go to one of these things where all the real lobbying happens, that's where we can really find out what they're up to and what they're doing to the public. So I wasn't supposed to be there, and it was very quickly kicked out.
Yeah, amazing. Oh, so they did kick you out of that. You didn't get a cigar off the silver platter.
I grabbed one, even though I had to lay the thing. It got me that quickly, Tom. It was fast. And then as I was leaving, just to add to it, as I was leaving, I decided I'm going right back to my hotel room. I'm going to write a blog about it. I run into two young gentlemen from the Center for American Progress who just got in a physical altercation with some ALEC staff.
Oh, that was Lee Fong.
They were outside of a restaurant saying to people as they left, "Were you with ALEC?" And the ALEC staff literally physically fought them.
Hold on. Just a second.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
State Representative Mark Pocan, Wisconsin State Representative, PocanForCongress.com. Thank you so much for being with us.
Absolutely. Thank you, Tom.
Great talk.
The Kochs would like to buy the world and make it all their own. It's grown too full of free ideas to really feel like home. Let's focus on the simple things like lower tax for all, and hope no one notices where the greatest benefit will fall.
That would be to the Koch brothers, yes. Welcome back, Tommy. Yes, we finance the Tea Party. Is that Jim Turr does that, Jacob? That's Blue Canyon Productions, and he does some great work. Scott Walker is proud to let you know the Republican governor of Wisconsin. He's proud to let you know that he has raised $13 million. This is in 3 months. This is pretty mind-boggling to raise $13 million in 3 months for a governor of a medium-sized state. Actually, population-wise, relatively small state compared to Texas, California, New York, Florida. So what is the significance of this? Well, here's what's really interesting. He's raised $13 million. He's using it on TV ads to talk about how wonderful he is. And everybody's looking, and they're seeing how, you know, he turned down that federal high-speed rail money, and he turned down federal assistance for poor people for health care, and he has laid off federal or state workers and cut jobs and cut benefits and cut pensions, and so people have less money. And so they're not buying as much, and so Wisconsin's kind of in a recession pretty bad, and in fact it has pretty bad unemployment. But I think the thing that grates people the most when they watch these ads for him, and it's just like it's cutting through it, you know? They're watching the ads, and they're going, you know, okay, he raised $13 million, which is paid for this ad, and he raised it by going to Texas and getting money from oil oligarchs there and going to New York City and to Wall Street and getting it from banking oligarchs there. And I think the citizens of Wisconsin are going, I don't think so. And this is a guy who got elected, I mean, just a year and a half ago. More than half. Did pretty good. The Commonwealth Fund just did a study. They looked at the 12 most developed OECD countries. The OECD is the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. It's basically the club of countries that are doing well. And there's 34 members, and the smallest is, I think, Costa Rica. So there's a lot of variety in there, but they looked at the 12 most developed of the OECD countries at healthcare costs. And in the United States, we spend an average of $8,000 per year per person. We are the most expensive in the world in terms of what we spend, the money that we pass out. The second and third most expensive countries in the world are Norway and Switzerland. And they spend $5,000 per person per year. And they both have longer lifespans than we do. They have better health outcomes than we do in almost everything. There are a couple categories where we beat them, but pretty much everything else, they got us nailed. And the study concluded, and this is a quote from the study, despite high costs, quality in the U.S. healthcare system is not notably superior to the far less expensive systems in the other study countries. In other words, the other countries that they studied. So bottom line, handing off $1 billion to Stephen J. Hemsley for running United Healthcare or $1 billion to his predecessor, Dollar Bill McGuire, has not made healthcare any better in the United States. It's just made Stephen Hemsley incredibly rich. And all the other CEOs of all the other health insurance companies. These people are basically banksters. They don't give shots. They don't look in kids' ears. They don't do surgery. They don't take out cancer. They don't cure disease. They're not even pharmacists. They're not even passing out prescriptions. They're not even the clerk in the pharmacy. They're not even ringing the cash register. Well, actually, they are ringing the cash register. They're bankers. And these banksters who run these companies called health insurance companies are ripping us off. I mean, the most expensive health care in the world on a per capita basis is Norway and Switzerland, and it's $5,000 per person per year on average, and we spend $8,000 per year per person. If we just, this is why it just blows my mind when you think about it. In most of these countries, the total overhead of the health care system is 2, 3, 4%. Medicare is 3%. I mean, how much does it cost to administer a system if you've got a single payer? You don't have, hundreds of different companies. And if the main job of the system is to make sure people get care rather than to make sure that they don't get care. The main goal of the big health insurance companies in the United States, the banksters, is to make sure that you don't get care. Because when you don't get care, they're profitable. And they were incorporated for one and only one reason, and that's to make a profit. So one of the amazing things that I looking at Obamacare, one of the things that totally blew my mind was, okay, Obamacare said, and this kicked in just very recently, that the health insurance companies have to have what's called a medical loss ratio. And isn't this bizarre that they call it medical loss ratio? It's the amount of money they actually spend keeping you well, paying for doctors, hospitals, drugs, things like that. The medical loss ratio must be 80%. In other words, for every $100 that you give to your health insurance company, they can only skim $20 off the top. Smaller companies, $25. Big companies, $20. Now, Medicare does it for $4. So there's still plenty of money to pay for Stephen J. Hemsley's limousines and his mansions and the corporate jets and all this kind of stuff. No problem. If we just got these banksters, blood-sucking leeches, essentially, these corporations that are sucking the healthcare blood out of America, off the back of the American people. We could save so much money, and people would get better health care. When are we going to figure this out?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
How do we get people engaged in a time of cynicism? You know, the majority of Americans want a national health care program. Yeah, best the good, the bad, and the very, very lenocinathously ugly. The good. Tampa Bay Buccaneers. Yesterday, the NFL team signed Eric LeGrand in a heartwarming and symbolic gesture. LeGrand played college football at Rutgers University, where he was tragically paralyzed in October of 2010. His dream was to always play in the NFL, and while it will never be able to happen, the Buccaneers and coach Greg Schiano wanted to give LeGrand the thrill of being signed to an NFL team. In an era when NFL teams are small corporations, it's nice to see that some corporate executives can still be class acts and do the right thing. The bad. Mitt Romney. At a fundraiser last night, Romney talked about how he commissioned American flag label pins for the Olympics in 2002 and used the story of the pins to explain how he hopes to bring America together if he's president. The only problem? Romney's pins were made in China, which kind of skews his whole patriotic message. But it's not surprising. Romney's Bain Capital outsourced hundreds of jobs during his tenure at the firm, and Bain and Romney's top economic advisor once said that offshoring American jobs was a good thing. I guess in Mitt Romney's head, the more jobs that are shipped overseas, the more patriotic America gets. And the very, very ugly Jody Brunstetter. Brunstetter is the wife of the North Carolina state legislator who introduced Amendment 1, which would outlaw same-sex marriage, civil unions, and domestic partnerships in that state. When asked by a citizen why her husband introduced the amendment, Brunstetter said, "The reason my husband wrote Amendment 1 was because the Caucasian race is diminishing and we need to reproduce." End of quote. In one answer, Brunstetter managed to support racial inequality in our country and fuel the conservative war on equal marriage rights. And that is very, very ugly. It's actually kind of impressive, you know, that she would just, like, blurt that out. Impressive is the wrong word, but shocking, Paul says. Yeah, that's... But, you know, it's a rare moment of candor. What's amazing about it is that she... I mean, this must be the way politics is done in North Carolina, at least, you know, wherever the, you know, whatever congressional district Mr. Brunstetter represents, that she would feel comfortable saying that. You know, we're doing this to ensure the survival of that. We can't, we got to keep the breeders and stop the non-breeders. You know, that's what we need to do. We need more breeders. Amazing. Jeff in Grand Rapids. Hey, Jeff, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. I'm a conservative in West Michigan here, and I think I agree with you that when you say that gun dealers and folks should be able to go put a table at an Occupy convention. I'm just not sure. Are you sure it's a political thing or just
market-driven? My point in suggesting that, and Jeff, your phone is breaking up, I'm sorry, but my point in suggesting that was to point out how crazy and how partisan this debate has come in the United States. Because I guarantee it, first of all, the NRA wouldn't do it because the Occupy people are more identified with the Democratic Party than the Republican Party, if any party at all. And secondly, and the NRA is all about the Republican Party because, as I pointed out in the second hour of this program, the Republican Party is not a political party anymore. It's a giant corporation made up of other corporations and billionaires who get their money from corporations. So, first of all, they wouldn't do it. But if I did it, if I went down to Tampa and I set up a table and I said, okay, come on, you know, we got guns for sale and you can get your carry, your concealed carry permit here, you know, fill in the forms and whatnot, or here's the instruction sheet and how to do it. I don't know what the laws are in Florida about how you go about doing that, but, you know, we would comply with the law, but we would be aggressively trying to arm Occupy protesters. Fox News would treat that the way that they went hysterical when the new Black Panther Party came along. You know, it was three guys and one of them had a stick. and they showed up at a polling place that was an African-American polling place. These were African-American guys. And basically, I think, as the story came out eventually, what they were doing was to make sure they were there to make sure that people could vote, not to stop people from voting, to make people sure people could vote, because the white lawyers would come in and challenge people's voting credentials. Well, not just white lawyers. I mean, the lawyers would come in. So anyhow, the Fox News, I mean, you know, for weeks, this is, look at this, black people with a stick. And can you match Occupy protesters with guns? But somehow America has become so bizarre that you say, well, yeah, RNC delegates with guns. Nobody thinks twice about it. It's incredible. George, Minneapolis. Hey, George, thanks for listening. What's up?
Well, I was listening to your show, and you were talking about life expectancy and how life expectancy is actually a poor metric for healthcare system, because a person's lifestyle is much more, has a much better determination of, you know, your life expectancy than actually the healthcare you get.
Well, how about infant mortality? We're with regard to infant mortality, we're worse than, you know, many third world countries.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because I was just about to talk about that.
Okay.
Because you're comparing apples and oranges.
All right.
Different countries count infant mortality differently. So you can't compare infant mortality in the United States. In the United States, if the head comes out and the baby's alive and the feet come out and it's dead, it's considered an infant mortality. But in other countries, an infant mortality can be declared several days or even a week or more after the child is born. So
I don't know that that's true. And, Georgia, is the bottom line here that you're trying to tell me that as long as the millionaires and billionaires, literally, in the healthcare industry continue making their millions and billions, that that's somehow going to improve our healthcare system? Is that your message?
No. I'm just trying to correct a misconception that a lot of liberals have, that infant mortality and lifespan is a good metric of our
Okay, how about obesity? We have the highest obesity rate in the developed world. Obesity is generally considered to be malnutrition.
Yeah, and that has nothing to do with our healthcare system.
Why not?
You
don't think the people who can see their doctor more often are going to be encouraged to live a healthy lifestyle?
I doubt it. I've heard where doctors talk about overeating or exercise or about a person's obesity, then they go complain to the hospital. And the hospital or the clinic gets on the doctor's case because the patient doesn't want to be.
So, George, in your mind, what if our – apparently you think our healthcare system is just fine, even with 50 million people.
Where did I say that?
Well,
you're making an invalid assumption.
Apparently I am. So tell me what your bottom line is here, George.
You're setting up a false dichotomy of our current healthcare system or a government-run healthcare system. I'm not buying into that, and I don't accept it.
Okay, so what would you accept?
Okay. For one thing, the failure of our healthcare system is not a market failure, because there's very little left of the free market in our healthcare system. There's no industry in our country that has a higher degree of government involvement in it than our healthcare system. So what we're looking at when you look at our current healthcare system is a government failure and not a market
failure.
That's
nonsense, George. The involvement that the government has, this is a classic example of you know, figures don't lie, but liars can figure. You're right. There is a massive government involvement in our healthcare system, because you don't want to be taking a drug that hasn't been checked out by the FDA. You don't want to have, you know, needles stuck in your arms.
People do it all the time. They can't get the health care in our country that's not approved by our federal government or our state government, so they go elsewhere.
But
they go underground. They go to black markets. They go to other countries to get their health care that they want that's not been approved by our federal or state governments.
George, are you suggesting that – well, I don't get the bottom line of your message here. That you think that the system that we have. Oh, I know what I was going to say. You said that this is not the failure of the free market. You know, in Switzerland, there is no government health care program.
What?
Did you know that in Switzerland, there's no government health care program?
So?
The difference between Switzerland and the United States. In Switzerland, it's on average, they're the second most expensive in the world. Okay. In Switzerland, it's on average $5,000 a person. In the United States, it's on average $8,000 a person. The difference between Switzerland and the United States, and they have dozens of healthcare companies that compete for your business in Switzerland. The difference between the two is that in Switzerland, it is a crime to offer healthcare on a for-profit basis. In the United States, it's not. We're the only developed country in the world that allows people like Stephen Jay Hemsley to make $1 billion off healthcare. Every other country in the world, healthcare companies, health insurance companies, have to operate as nonprofits, like they used to have to in every state in the United States up until basically the Reagan administration, back when healthcare used to be cheap here in the United States, too. So, you know,
to that I say, so what?
The so what is that it is proof that it is not a failure of the market. It's the difference between for profit and not for profit. Helen in Michigan. Hey, Helen, what's up? You wanted to talk about Rick Snyder.
Hello. First thing, I agree totally with you about the health care.
Thank you.
And I'm a nurse.
Ah,
I'm in health care industry.
You have some authority.
And it's not going to get any better as long as it's, like you said, a health care industry.
Yeah.
People don't understand it's for profit, and those people running those companies, the only legal obligation they have is to provide a return on the investment of their stockholders.
That's absolutely right. And Helen, very, very well said, and thanks for calling in as a nurse and validating that. It is 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We'll be right back with more of your thoughts on the issues of the day. And I got to tell you very quickly when we come back from the break why Grover Norquist is probably locked in a closet someplace right now, sobbing. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
No, seriously, he's probably having a nervous breakdown. I've met Grover. He's, or maybe not. I don't know. Maybe he's just having a good drink with another lobbyist. But.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming.
So here's why Grover Norquist is probably locked in a closet sobbing right now. In California, the polls are showing that 60% of the voters want, and the California legislature can't do this because the right wingers, probably it was put together by ALEC. They got this law passed that California can't raise taxes without a supermajority, with a two-thirds vote in the assembly. And they got enough Republicans that they can prevent that from happening. So Jerry Brown is getting this thing on the ballot so that the voters will do it directly, go around the legislature, go around the Republicans in the legislature, and say, we're going to raise state taxes on anybody making over $250,000 a year, and only on the income that they make after that $250,000 has been earned, so that we don't have to cut our schools and our hospitals. More than 60% of Californians are totally in favor of this. Grover Norquist has to be having a nervous breakdown. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number, and Bill in Knoxville, Tennessee. Hey, Bill, thanks for listening to XM. What's up?
Oh, Tom, I'm so glad I got through to you. I'm a big listener, and I'm a great Democrat, and I'm on the right side of most issues. My problem with Occupy Wall Street issue is that I make $350,000 a year, and I feel like I can't wrap my head around.
You're $15,000 a year short of being in the top 1%.
Oh, is that true?
I think it's 365, but I could be wrong.
My partner makes another 100 on top of us, so we make a good living, but
sure.
We believe in what they stand for, and I feel like I don't know how to belong to the movement making so much money. I pay my taxes.
Yeah.
And I vote the right way, and I just want
I think
to hear
you're
what
doing,
your opinion was.
I think you're doing
list.
Just fine, Bill. And it's really not the 1% that is screwing America, as you well know. In fact, in a lot of cities in the United States, you know, the kind of money that you're making is not considered big money if you're living in downtown San Francisco or New York City or something like that. Although there's
right.
a lot of people around who would say it is, but you know,
in
New York City, well, you're calling from Tennessee, so I guess it probably is big money in most parts of Tennessee, but even in
right.
Knoxville. But nonetheless, it's really not the 1%. I mean, the 99%, 1% is a nice, easy, simple, it's a bumper sticker, right? But really, right. It's the 1/100th of 1%, and it's not even all of them. I mean, there are some very good billionaires out there. Bill Gates is saying, "Raise my taxes." Warren Buffett's right. saying, "You know, raise my taxes." There are wealthy people who own some of the radio stations that run. I mean, there's some good people who are out there, and who donate to Free Speech TV and you know Democracy Now and other. There's some great folks. The problem isn't the 1% versus 99% of the split in income, although the wealth disparities in the United States are becoming a social problem. The problem is the people who believe that buying government is the best investment they can make, that instead of and the Supreme Court that has allowed this to happen, that instead of making money by selling widgets in the marketplace, they can make money by buying legislators and getting the tax law adjusted so that General Electric, for example, last year made billions and billions of dollars in profits and paid nothing in taxes. ExxonMobil last year, $400 million in profits, or you know, some amazing amount, nothing in taxes. And on the list goes. You know, Apple, it was just outed for all, you know, 2.9, was a billion, as I recall, that simply by having an office in Nevada instead of California and just saying that they're doing all their business out of that office, even though everything's happening in Cupertino, they're not paying the state a whole, you know, pile of money. And
well, I pay my fair share, and I'm willing to pay more if it goes to the right places. And I just don't want to feel hypocritical because I believe in Move On or on Occupy Wall Street and those kinds of folks,
yeah.
And I support them. So.
Well, good on you, Bill. Good on you. And the movement needs everybody on board, including people like yourself and including people a lot wealthier than you who are of goodwill. The problem is parasite is the wrong word. The predators among us who see, you know, who are just out for everything that they can get and to hell with society. And so anyhow, Bill, I'm going to move along, but thank you for the call and thanks for your kind words and thanks for being a good guy. Dominic in upstate New York. Hey, Dominic, what's up?
Tom, thanks for taking my call. I've listened to your radio station a few times, and I must say it's a pleasure to hear you call out both Democrats and Republicans. It's refreshing, you know, to just call the truth the truth. The only thing I wanted to can you give me some backup information on the statement you made about the is it the health insurance companies that were not for profit in this country until Reagan, or was it the health industry? Because I brought this up to someone who was a CEO of health insurance for 35 years, and he's telling me nonsense. And I didn't know where to turn, to be honest with you.
Well, in most states, I don't actually. Probably the best resource would be T.R. Reid's book. T.R. Reid traveled around the world. He visited he profiled five different countries. It was made into a two-hour documentary for public broadcasting for PBS, and you'll have to Google the name of it. I want to say Healthcare Around the World, but I could be wrong. And he wrote a book that goes along with it. And he was a guest on this program and talked about these issues. And, in fact, he pointed out in his documentary for PBS that the United States is the only nation in the developed world, in the civilized world, that allows health insurance to be sold on a for-profit basis. They took that out of the PBS special. They took that paragraph out, that little, you know, minute or so out of it. And he was so incensed by that, he had them take his name off it. And this is no secret. This, you can easily track this story down, and he's got the book out. And one of the things that he pointed out, and I remember back in Michigan, back in the 70s, I was an employer. I owned a company, and I had employees, and I was paying like $35-40 a month for health insurance for my employees. Because Blue Cross Blue Shield that we were buying it from at that time in Michigan, under state law in Michigan, had to be a not-for-profit. Those laws have all changed. These were all state laws. These were not federal laws. So you'll probably have to track it down state by state, but I'm quite sure the T.R. Reid documents it in his book because he certainly talked about it on this program. So anyhow, tomorrow is Friday, so it'll be Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls on all the topics of the day, plus Anything Goes Friday. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up, when you participate. It is not a spectator sport. It is a participatory sport. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.